The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they're easy, but because they are hard.
Three, two, one.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston. Broadcasting from 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good afternoon, listeners. Welcome to our Sunday Space Show program, and I'm your host, David Livingston. Thank you very much for tuning in today. And we have a most informative, excellent speaker. I will introduce her in just a minute. A couple of quick announcements. We're on our 90-minute format today, so please still pay attention to the timing of the show. If you want to get a call in to our guest or an email, make sure you do it while we still have time on air to have the program answer and respond to you. But again, we're looking at the 90-minute program today. We have a full week of programming on the Space Show coming up. And so Dana Andrews is with us. He's a retired Boeing and Andrews Aerospace engineer, a lifetime of incredible space work. And he has a new book called Chasing the Dream. From an insider's point of view, you will absolutely really appreciate hearing from Dr. Andrews. Eric Berger is our Hotel Mars guest on Wednesday, and you know the topic, SpaceX. Lots of on the news there, their successful flight and docking, plus their unsuccessful test resulting in destruction, again, on the Starliner components that they're testing, I mean Starship components. Friday, we have a guest from Spain, Mr. Sampera from Satelliot, if I'm doing that correctly. They are a 5G company, and we're going to talk for the first time specifically on the Space Show about 5G technology and what it is all about, and then open lines on Sunday. So it is a full week of Space Show programming. We hope all of you enjoy us. For today, our toll-free number, 1-866-687-7223. No call screeners, just be patient, and we'll bring you up on air as quickly as possible. You can always still reach us as well with email, drspace@thespaceshow.com. Our weekly newsletter is already posted, and you'll find it in the upper right of our homepage. Everything we do is archived for your easy listening online. We're downloading the shows. Don't forget our Space Show store. And you go there by clicking on Pepper's picture, listening to the Space Show. And that is our logo wear store. Hopefully you'll see some things of interest for you. And then there's a listen live button upper left. Tells you how to listen to the live program like we're doing right now. Plus our podcast and our MP3s on our website archives. And, of course, we're happy to answer any questions you might have. Just email me, drspace@thespaceshow.com. Then please remember, we are a 501c3 nonprofit listener-supported program, and that means that you, the listener, keep us on the air with your great support, and we appreciate that, especially those of you able to continue to support us during these challenging economic times as well as healthcare times. And again, that support and ongoing support is very, very much appreciated and needed. Don't forget we have a great PayPal button at the top of our homepage. That's the easiest and best way to support us. There's also a check if you want to make it payable to One Giant Leap Foundation, and it mails to Box 95, Tiburon, California, 94920. And then we also do sponsors. Remember, the sponsors get the banner ads running across the homepage. I will read our sponsor messages as we break today between the first and the second segments, but we still are taking additional sponsors for 2020, and if you're interested, let me know that your messages last forever because they stay on the archived version of the show. So it is a great way to continually get your imprint out there. And the best way to reach me about that is email Dr. Space. Excuse me, my voice seems to be going again, at thespaceshow.com. So for today, I'm very happy to introduce for the first time Dr. Joyce Lau. I hope I'm pronouncing her last name correctly. And she is at Stanford, and she is the director of the Neuro-Ophthalmology Service and Neuro-Ophthalmology Fellowship, as well as co-director of the Vision Research Training Program. She does have a full bio on our website that you can read about, but she has been doing research with eye-brain issues in microgravity. And in fact, she has an excellent YouTube video presentation by that title, Eye-Brain Issues in Microgravity. I will link to it when I archive the program. I would urge all of you to watch that, because the visuals are fantastic. She has really done a great job. But we have her with us today to talk about eye-brain issues in microgravity, what they are, why they're there, can anything be done about it, how important are they, or how serious are they. Dr. Lau, welcome to the Space Show. How are you today?
I'm doing well. Good afternoon, everybody, and it's such a pleasure and privilege to be part of this amazing show.
We thank you for being with us. Give us an introduction to what you mean by eye-brain issues, and why do they result in microgravity, and how do you know they're unique, or are they not unique to microgravity?
Oh, terrific. So eye-brain issues are common in space. And it's probably the number one reason why we are, as humans, unable to go to long-duration space flights or expeditions such as colonization of the moon or a trip to Mars. So let me back up a little bit just to talk about some basics. We talk about the eye-brain network because this is how we see the world. The eyes basically act like a camera, and it captures the visual information around us. And that information is transmitted through the eye, through the optic nerve, to the brain for interpretation. So everything we see in the world is actually because our brain tells us, by interpreting the information. So this information transfer happens rapidly. If we take a walk outside, we look at the world around us, and we're constantly processing, capturing, and interpreting the information as we go. So you could imagine we're such visually dependent creatures that what we see is basically one of the most important senses that allow us to survive in the real world. So in space, what happens is the microgravity environment causes a condition that particularly affects the eye and the brain because it's through the effect of the microgravity as well as the space environment. In terms of the effect of microgravity, we don't know for sure what's going on, but we think part of it has to do with altered fluid space distribution in our body. For Earth, we have gravity, and so what happens is the fluid tends to drain downwards. For example, some people, if they sit for too long and have their leg on the ground, sometimes the feet swell. So that's because of the effect of gravity sort of pulling the fluid downwards. So we don't have this effect of gravity in space. And so fluid does not come downwards like we would normally expect. And as a result, fluid tends to shift toward our heads. And so when there's too much fluid around the head, you start to have altered fluid distribution and fluid transport. And that essentially leads to a net change of swelling in the optic nerve. So just to go back to what I was saying earlier, the optic nerve is basically the connection. It's the information highway that brings what we see in the eye. So the eye is like the camera, capturing the information and transporting the information to the brain. So when the visual information transport through the optic nerve is affected, because the nerve is either swollen or not working properly, you could have vision changes.
So you said earlier it's why we would have a hard time with space settlement, so to speak. But the Apollo astronauts did sort of long-term space flight, right? And of course, the space station has had people on for around a year. So they still seem to function, and their eye vision network, I guess, worked okay. So is it a factor of how much time you're in that environment?
So time definitely has something to do with it. Basically, longer than 3 months, this effect seems to be impacting the majority of astronauts. So I should clarify that we have a lot of astronauts who spend longer than 3 months, either in the International Space Station or, in other missions. And they are experiencing symptoms, visual changes, which I'm happy to talk about a little bit more, but it could be compensated. So what happens is, however, when they come back, what we see is that the majority of them, and when I say majority, I mean close to 100%, have changes in the eye and the brain that could be detected. And so we know some of these changes, most of them, in fact, resolve within 6 months of returning to Earth. But some changes are permanent. And the permanent changes have been shown to worsen during repeat deployment. And so what happens is essentially we suspect that this condition, the changes in the eye and the brain, probably gets worse over time, and certainly with repeat exposure. And so this is why it's a long-term problem.
You already have a telephone call from a listener. Are you ready to talk to a listener?
Sure.
Good morning. Good afternoon, listener. Welcome to the Space Show today. Who are you and where are you? And thank you very much for your call. Caller, are you there? Well, I know they're still there because we don't have a dial tone. So that means they haven't hung up. So caller, 123. Okay, caller, if you want to talk to us, call us back. They probably have a bad phone line. The number, if you are a caller, 1-866-687-7223. And again, call us back if you would like to talk to us. Is there any remedy? I mean, can you correct the problems if you recognize them while you're in space? And does whatever method you're using to correct them make a difference permanently?
Good question. So there are some things that you can do in space. And so the most important one is the most common problem is actually blurry vision. So because of the fluid shift and the swelling of the optic nerve and the back of the eye, what you have is a change in what we call the refractive error. So this is similar to as people get older, they need reading glasses. So in space, there's basically this rapid induction of reading correction. So just to clarify, this is someone who will be able to see okay at distance, but then would need some different eyeglasses or eye correction for reading up close. So this type of blurriness is optical, meaning it's due to just, basically where the world falls precisely on the back of the eye in terms of a focusing issue. And so they do have these adaptable reading glasses that you could immediately shift so that, you're able to see clearly. So that's one of the common things that can be done in space to correct for the blurry vision.
Okay, the caller is possibly calling us back. Let's see if it works this time. Hi, caller. Are you with us? And thank you for calling.
Hi, this is John in Fremont, California.
Hi, John. Were you the previous caller we lost?
I was not.
Okay. Nice to talk to you again. You're on the show with Dr. Lau.
Hi, Dr. Lau. I enjoyed your presentation at AIAA. So I did want to follow up on one of the questions I asked you, but before we get into that, is the data you're basing these results on mainly from the International Space Station?
Yes. So the most amount of data is from people who have deployed to ISS because there aren't too many other examples, you know, of people spending months in space.
Right, right. That's what I figured. So we don't know if there's like a spectrum of these effects that would manifest in lower gravity environments like on the moon or Mars. If you had some gravity, would that mitigate it at all?
That's a great question. Based on the model, you know, what we think is causing these eye-brain issues, we would predict that the effect would be less in low gravity condition. These are certainly things that can be tested on Earth, you know, so we could simulate low gravity or microgravity conditions to look at the difference in the effect. But I think the key thing to remember is not all of these effects are related to just sheer change in the gravity. For example, on Earth, part of the pressure gradients are important between the eye and the brain is the pressure gradient between the eye pressure and the brain pressure, which is right around the optic nerve. So, you know, basically the space, the little space where our optic nerve is coming out of the eyeball, is experiencing this pressure gradient. And this pressure gradient is influenced by gravity, but it's not dependent entirely on gravity. So there's sort of an indirect effect. So, let's say there is a change in, the sort of pressure gradient across, from the eyeball to the brain space itself. We don't know the effect of that in a human, in prolonged exposure to like a moon, you know, lower gravity situation versus microgravity in space. So these are, I think, really interesting observations that we'll know with successful, future expedition to moon or other spaces.
Go ahead.
I was just going to jump in. Is there any idea if artificial gravity would make a difference, or is there something about artificial gravity that might not count, for example, or might not matter?
We think artificial gravity would make a difference, but currently the easiest way to induce artificial gravity is really only physiologically possible for mice. So there is research, probably the best developed research is from JAXA, the Japanese space agency. So they developed this. It's a 3D printed centrifuge that spins to simulate gravity. And they have actually really nice videos of what these animals look like immediately upon exposure to microgravity versus after they've been adapted for a while. It's kind of incredible. I show some of the videos during my talk at the AIAA. So if you get to the end of the talk, you'll see these videos. So basically, the rodents, because of the smaller body mass, mice in particular are able to tolerate this type of centrifugation. But this is not really possible for slightly larger rodents like rats, and certainly not possible for humans. But if there's a safe way that we can induce artificial gravity in a larger animal or even in human beings, we would think that some of these effects, or maybe a lot of these effects on the eye and the brain would be mitigated.
John, go ahead now.
Well, you asked the question for me, David, but with the importance of mitigating these effects, don't you think we should start planning for a variable gravity facility for human use?
So I think absolutely more research is needed. Currently, we prepare our astronauts for space expedition through these, you know, control sort of claustrophobic simulated environment. To my knowledge, they don't spend a whole lot of time on variable gravity. I'm not sure if this process is limited by, you know, technical issues or, you know, matter of prioritizing, you know, different things. One of the successful examples of correcting human health factors in space is bone density studies. And because of that, now we know the astronauts have to exercise something like 2 hours a day and, you know, do weightlifting and et cetera to combat the changes due to the microgravity effect on bone density and reentry. So, you know, we've been able to do, been successful in that way for one important health issue, and it would absolutely be important to go to, for example, either microgravity or variable gravity type of environments for sustained periods of time to better understand the impact on the eye and the brain. And because of that, the eye-brain issues are one of the most important and a top priority for NASA.
Yeah, well, more research is needed for sure.
Yes.
Anything else, John? Or
that's about it for me, David. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Listeners,
thank you for calling in.
If you want to give us a call, listeners, it's 866-687-7223. Does this research suggest astronaut screening to not accept people with eye problems or already needing reading glasses, because it's going to be a lot worse for them than people that come into the field that have great vision and good eyes?
Well, as you know, our astronauts already go through extensive screening, and in general, they're required to have 20/20 visual acuity. Unlike the rest of us for driving, you know, the requirement is 20/40 in one eye, you know. And for astronauts, the part of the rigorous vision screening does allow for the possibility of wearing glasses or even corrective surgery to achieve the 20/20 vision. So these people, you know, with a correction, they're not necessarily excluded from space expedition. And in fact, we don't know if they are at greater risk for these issues or not. So the way to think about it is they are corrected to 20/20 with normal, you know, not swollen optic nerve and good eye-brain function, usually at, you know, top levels before flight. And then these changes occur. So, in fact, we don't know whether someone who is, let's say, nearsighted would be at greater risk or not from these eye-brain issues. There is an interesting information. It turns out that women are less susceptible to these eye-brain issues than men, for reasons that we don't yet understand. And so, as you could imagine, there are fewer female astronauts. And so there's actually not a publication that addresses this in detail, you know, like exactly what are the differences between men and women. But this has already been discussed as an important factor, and there are theories about it. But essentially, there are questions whether these future, you know, expedition to Mars or something like it might be a female dominant crew as opposed to, you know, the typical male dominant crew for current space missions.
What about age? Is there an age correlation to having this problem?
Most of the astronauts who undergone this type of long-term, long-duration, space flight experience are, on average, on the younger side, and certainly our astronauts in general are getting a little bit older. Most people are entering the space program much earlier than developing presbyopia, which is, the needing reading glasses to read. So in general, we don't know whether age has to do with these development of eye brain issues. That certainly has not been studied. But I could tell you that there are a lot of changes with normal aging that indicate that individuals who are older may be more likely to develop issues in space because we're now beginning to understand the effect of microgravity on the immune system, for example, which has certain changes with normal aging. And so I think similar to the response to the previous comment from John from Fremont, I think it's one of those things that needs more research. And I would emphasize that this type of research, so the age research is also important all of us on Earth in terms of how it relates to our ability to fight off infections like the COVID-19 pandemic that's occurring right now, as well as just normal aging and eye brain health.
So Sharon is in Seattle, and she said there are certainly other problems other than microgravity. So one is radiation. So does radiation overlap with microgravity to worsen visual problems somehow?
We think there's likely a contribution of radiation because it does impact. Radiation has greater impact on more rapidly dividing cells. The bottom line is we don't have a lot of data on this, but the reason radiation is important is because the blood vessels that support our eye-brain network and the glial cells, so these are they outnumber the neurons 10 to 1. So there are 10 support cells called glial cells to every one neuron in our central nervous system. So these are cells that are more rapidly dividing, and they help maintain the health of our eye-brain network, essentially. So radiation can certainly impact these cells. They could also increase the risk of mutations in the in all cells in the body, including neurons, which are not dividing. So you can imagine that the impact may be more critical from that way. And then finally, it has impact on the immune system. So we think it's a contributing factor to eye-brain issues in space. It's probably not the most important factor. But the importance of shielding the astronauts from radiation effects are well known. And this is, I think, an area that's been undergoing a lot of research, probably longer than the eye-brain issues. We just haven't quite figured out the right way to mitigate the effect of radiation, because it's just not possible to wear a suit, that would shield everything from radiation.
Ben in Denver sent in a note, and I have a caller on hold for you. But Ben said, to prevent the optic nerve from swelling, can you prophylactically take anti-inflammatories?
There's been discussion about prophylactically taking some type of medication for eye brain issues in space. The final discussion ended with not doing anything because of the potential side effect and sort of theoretical benefit. I think it's important to recognize the contribution of the immune system to the eye brain issues, but it's likely that the immune system problem is not the primary cause of eye brain issue, but it absolutely takes place, you know, as a secondary phenomenon. And the trouble with the immune aspect is we don't know which part of the immune system to regulate. So there is an explosion of immunomodulatory therapy that could target different parts of the immune system, anywhere from old-fashioned corticosteroids like prednisone that people could take as a pill, to very, very precisely targeting monoclonal antibodies against interleukin-6, for example. So there are many, many ways of targeting the immune system, and they all technically fall under the anti-inflammatory umbrella. But, you know, basically we don't know enough to actually be treating. One drug that's been thought about a little bit more than the anti-inflammatory approach is using drug to lower brain pressure. The classic is the same one that you would take if you were climbing Mount Everest. So at high altitude, people develop some of these issues that's related to changes in the body. And people would take something called acetazolamide, which is a carbonic anhydrase inhibitor that regulates many different parts of the body, including reducing the symptoms of high altitude. And then in patients, we use that as a treatment to lower brain pressure. So there's been discussion, you know, what if we take drugs that would prophylactically lower or normalize brain pressure and hope that would help with the eye brain issues in space. But there are a lot of potential side effects, and not to mention that brain pressure is not the only aspect of the eye brain issue. So no prophylaxis is ever actually implemented, but many, many countermeasures are discussed. From a non-pharmacologic standpoint, people have also thought about using sort of mechanical changes. So this would be ways of changing the fluid shift in the body, kind of like a equivalent to artificial gravity, you know, basically pulling fluid away from the brain. That doesn't work for long term. And then there's also discussion about wearing basically equivalent of swimming goggles to kind of suck on the eyeballs a little bit to change that pressure gradient between the eye and the brain. And so there are a lot of interesting ideas. None are quite implemented, but, you know, they're very interesting what we'll end up doing in the future to counter these issues.
So I know people who have gone mountain climbing and their doctors had them acclimate with blood thinners. Is that a possible treatment, or is that for something else?
For blood thinner, that's related to a completely different issue. And blood thinners are potentially associated with a lot of issues. So it's also not something that's recommended for, in general, for high altitude or in space.
You have another caller waiting on hold. Hi, caller. Welcome to the program. Who are you today, and where are you, please?
I'm still just Marshall in Renfro.
Okay. Hi, Marshall. Welcome back.
Hey, yes. I like to play ping pong, and I noticed that if I'm wearing my bifocals, sometimes the ball kind of goes, you know, does a little jump, and I totally miss the ball. Is there any problem in space you reach for something and it's not quite where you think it is?
So that's actually a very good comparison of what happens in space. So as you know, bifocals can correct optically. for, you know, near versus far, there's the, you know, bifocal, right? One, like looking straight for distance and then looking a little bit down at close up for near. But the problem with bifocal is you have this limited field of view where you have good, crisp vision. And so it's actually similar, too, for progressives. So progressives are basically like, you know, a gradient of optical correction rather than too precise corrections. And what happens in bifocal is the glasses is optically designed with a focal length that's much closer to you. And so the bifocals are only in focus if it's close to you. And so when the ping pong ball comes to you, you're looking at it through the top of the bifocal, you know, at distance. But as it gets to you, it gets blurry because you can't accommodate or focus up close. So then you have to tilt your head, meaning tilt your glasses a little bit to look toward the bifocal part of your glasses. And the jump comes from the fact that, you know, it's moving and coming at you fast, and you're trying to adapt by trying to focus on the ball. And so it's just a very clumsy process, unfortunately. And so for astronauts in space, they have kind of a similar thing, except fortunately, I think they're not usually dealing with things coming, you know, as fast as a ping pong ball. So they can adapt. But the adaptation is difficult because, let's say they're wearing a bifocal like you, they would need to constantly look straight or tilt their head. And in fact, this is one of the most common cause of sort of neck back issues for all of us who need bifocal glasses. You know, we're looking at the computer and then tilting our head looking through the bifocal, you know, giving us a headache essentially. So yeah, really, really good question.
Yeah. In general, in the space station, they really don't do anything that requires a real fast reflex motion, right?
Generally, no. But an important thing to remember is when they're traveling across different parts of the space station, you know, they have to kind of move, right? So
yeah.
Even if that's not super fast, they're still moving. And so as they move, let's say they have to wear this bifocal, you know, because of the eye brain changes. Part of what they're looking at is blurry and part of what they're looking at is crisp. And, you know, there's just a whole lot of issue with vision in general when you have that problem. And it could also impact your depth perception because depth perception requires that you see well in each eye and the two eyes are lined up. So that mismatch of the, you know, blurry focus but still, you know, able to cross the eyes, you know, that mismatch is really problematic. So it's a real issue in space.
I think you brought up an interesting point, and that is I always assumed both eyes had the same problem. And you could actually have one eye that one optical nerve that swells a little bit more than the other, and gee, your parallax goes screwy.
Yes. And in fact, this is one of the important differences between the eye brain issue in microgravity versus the patients on Earth who have high brain pressure. So the patients on Earth with high brain pressure, the majority have swelling in both optic nerves. So they're more symmetric. Whereas in the eye brain space issue, they're much more likely to be asymmetric. And that causes, you know, a real challenge, as you discussed.
Yeah, well, the poor guy running the robotic arm probably has fits. Anyway, that's enough for me today.
Thank you, Marsha. I appreciate
your
call. Listeners, the line is available. If you would like to call us, 866-687-7223. Donald is in Denver, Colorado. And he said, so on the 6 to 9 month mission to Mars, does this condition worsen over the time? Or if you're going to have some form of artificial gravity, is there any kind of guess as to how many hours a day you would have to spend in artificial gravity and at what dose level to mitigate the problem on a flight to Mars? Hi, it dropped the call for some reason. I've got you back on the show.
Yes.
You didn't hear my question, I take it, did you? Or the question that Donald offered from Denver.
I did not. Yeah, basically, I think when the previous caller hung up, somehow I was also dropped.
It dropped. So Donald wants to know if on a 6 to 9 month mission to Mars, does the problem worsen over time? And if you're going to mitigate with artificial gravity, is there any kind of a guess how many hours a day you would need to spend in artificial gravity and at what dose level?
We presume that this problem would worsen over time if it's untreated. So it's not only important to have a way to mitigate it, but also to actually prevent it from happening. So we don't have any good options for either at this time. So assuming that some type of artificial gravity would mitigate this process, because, you know, it would make sense if it is part of the cause, then it could be something as substantial as the 2 hour equivalent exercise that would be needed to mitigate changes in bone density loss, and possibly more, because if we are experiencing a constant shift, in terms of the fluid and pressure gradient across the optic nerve, you may actually have to compensate for that for much longer than 2 hours a day. But again, these are all just, good hypotheses at this point.
Robert in Austin, Texas, has a question, and he said, I know in radiation there are experiments with pills or medicines that might mitigate some of the radiation. So could there be some kind of strategies to stop the optic nerve from swelling, or maybe even a manual strategy, like you wear some kind of comfortable but effective space helmet?
I think the ultimate treatment will be probably a combination of some type of device, as well as some kind of pharmacologic prevention. But these countermeasures, I think you have to balance the benefit, the side effect, and the ease of use. It's kind of a it reminds me of when people design protective eye gear for military use, that it looks so ugly that nobody would wear it. And everybody would be, much more willing to wear the lower sort of eye protective glasses that look much more attractive. And so that's kind of a small example of, what happens in space. So I think our astronauts are, these are amazing people who could put up with a lot, but if it's going to interfere with their work, then, realistically, they could only wear it for certain numbers of hours.
Is an astronaut crew trained sufficiently to deal with another astronaut that is having vision problems from this? And is there any training that they could get to where they could actually help the astronaut having the problem?
The astronauts are actually trained to take care of themselves as well as each other. There are many good examples of how they do this in space. There's some nice pictures and videos you could see that's available through NASA and online. So currently the space is the International Space Station is fitted with a variety of different ways to measure the eye-brain network. So they can measure their own visual acuity, their own visual field. They could basically hold up a camera to take a picture of their own eye. So this is a color photo that you would use to take a picture of the optic nerve. We can measure they can measure their own eye pressure. They can also use the ultrasound to look in the back of the eye. And then the newest technology to image the eye is something called optical coherence tomography, or OCT. And this is basically a instrument that uses light in a way that is like ultrasound. You know, you're looking at the interference pattern of light instead of sound. And that gives you a very high-resolution measurement and image of the eye, which is part of the brain, so at a micron level, so 10 to the minus 6 meter resolution. So these are all ways that the astronauts can measure and take care of their own eyes in space. So, you know, they kind of have to be their own eye doctor, essentially. Astronauts are trained to be quite self-sufficient in, you know, helping with their own medical needs if necessary.
So what do? They get all these readings and then they send it back to Houston, who an eye doctor tells them what to do. Is that the overall strategy, or do they come up with a conclusion and what they have to do on their own?
It is exactly as you described. So the information, these, you know, images and data can be transmitted back home, and there's a, you know, a whole team of experts who can advise them on what to do. And in fact, this is how the eye-brain issues in space are typically monitored and diagnosed. And there are examples that are published in scientific journals that show how astronauts who previously had these eye-brain issues developed again in space. And then, you know, some of these changes are permanent, as I mentioned. And this is why they have spent a lot of money to make these equipment necessary in space. So in 2018, the newest version of this optical coherence tomography machine, or OCT machine, was flown to the International Space Station and installed in late 2018 because of this. So this is a sizable instrument that people who are in eye doctor's offices, some of these instruments are not even available in routine eye care because it's you know, pretty cutting edge and you know, large and expensive. But they made the investment to fly one to space because of the importance of this problem.
And they work okay in microgravity?
They were certainly tested, and I have not seen a data from this particular machine, you know, the newest generation coming back from space. But I'm sure they've been collecting it, so I'm kind of interested to see. Hopefully, someone will publish something soon. This is an area that we've been doing research on Earth, and the analysis of this type of data is actually not trivial. And so, you know, we'd love to be able to see what this data looks like. But yeah, absolutely, they've been collecting it probably for over a year now.
We're a little past halfway, so I'm going to break for 2 minutes and thank our sponsor. So please hold on the line, but we'll take a pause as we get ready to move to the second segment for about 2 minutes. And listeners, I do want to thank our great sponsors. Not only do they have the banner ad, which I urge you to click on and see what's underneath it from time to time. Remember, the sponsors get to change it whenever they want. But Northrop Grumman sponsors us, and they are, as everybody knows, a leading global security company providing innovative systems, products, and solutions for both the government and commercial customers globally, from undersea to outer space and cyberspace. The Space Foundation sponsors us. And they typically have their big global, very important symposium around the end of March to the early part of April. They canceled it this year because of COVID. Go to spacesymposium.org to see how it is going to be either rescheduled or replaced. And you need to go to at least one of these events. The networking is unbelievable, as well as the programming. So, again, this is the Space Foundation. You can check it out at spacesymposium.org. Astrox sponsors us. They've been involved in hypersonic space plane and reusable rocket designs by the Air Force, DARPA, and NASA for more than 30 years. Their codes, HiSight and SpaceSight, create and analyze these designs. And for more information, visit Astrox, ASTROX.com. The AIAA sponsors us. They're the ones that did the talk that we've been talking about from time to time with our guest today. The American Institute of Aeronautics and Astronautics. It is the world's largest aerospace professional society. And they have five main events a year, but they're doing a lot of regional breakfast, luncheon, and dinner presentations as well this year. So check them all out. You don't need to be an engineer to join. AIAA.org, and great organization. Moonwords, what if a group of nations was determined to build a town on the moon, and then they based their decisions only on technical and economic merit? Moonwords is building a digital vision of that town where you will be able to learn, play, build, and go to events. Visit moonwords.com, download an early draft of the demo of the town, and fund its development by subscribing. Help us help the world see a bigger future where we can leave our past behind us. Celestis sponsors us, and they are the pioneer and iconic global provider of memorial spaceflight services. So remember, you can do a suborbital flight out of New Mexico, orbital out of Florida, and possibly elsewhere. They're getting ready to go to the moon of the first quarter in 2021. That will be their second flight to the moon. And you can add some of your DNA to go with a little bit of the ashes or DNA of your loved one, and you can do the flight symbolically. For more information, contact Celestis.com. The NSS, National Space Society, and ISDC sponsors us. 2020 got canceled, and it's combined with 2021 in Los Angeles. So for more information, go to NSS.org. And click on ISDC 2021. It is at the Sheraton Hotel in Los Angeles at the end of May, the early part of June. And then the Integrated Space Plan sponsors us, the highly detailed development flowchart showing the path to becoming a spacefaring race. Technologies and destinations build on one another. You can see this all on their virtual plan at thespaceplan.com. You can also buy a copy of it. So for more information, to buy your copy, to get it framed, check it all out at thespaceplan.com. And we're talking today with Dr. Joyce Lau, a Stanford ophthalmologist. We're talking about eye-brain issues, primarily in microgravity. Dr. Lau, your AIAA paper, which I will link to, well, it's a YouTube presentation. Your subtitle is Effects of Hypoxia. And you sent me a draft of your paper, and I appreciate that. And hypoxia is mentioned quite a bit. Plus, of course, you mentioned it with COVID. Why is hypoxia an issue? So I understand from a layman's point of view that is a reduction in oxygen, and that would certainly probably happen in space. Make the connection with hypoxia and eye-brain issues.
Very good. So the International Space Station is pressurized to sea level, and so there's not a concern about hypoxia at ISS when everything is working. But in general, hypoxia is a concern for commercial airplane as well as, you know, military and other types of aircraft. There's a concern about hypoxia. And that's because most airplanes are not pressurized to sea level, except in private contracts where I think you kind of pay for that type of environment. Most aircraft is pressurized to equivalent of mild to moderate high altitude. So essentially, I think to sort of put it all together, there's a concern of a potential effect of hypoxia in general with any type of flight. Another way to think about it is hypoxia is a sort of a component for many diseases in general. So the COVID-19 example is obviously related to infection, but the infection leads to pneumonia, which leads to a low level of oxygen in the blood, which then leads to the hypoxic effect in the whole body. And it triggers a very profound immune reaction, which is the most common cause of the rapid deterioration in COVID-19. So I think another important thing to recognize in terms of hypoxia and space travel is that there are these confluence of factors. So these are signaling pathways that are triggered as a result of radiation or these eye brain issues that tap into the same hypoxic network of responses. So genes are turned on as a result of these type of responses, either specifically hypoxia-related or immune-related, essentially all converging onto a pathway that increases free radicals. And these are, you know, things that are sometimes called reactive oxygen species that then execute the effect on the tissue, so on the eye and the brain and in our bodies. So I think the important is to recognize the potential effect of hypoxia. And in fact, the pilots undergo this hypoxia experience. It's a routine part of training to be a pilot to recognize your own hypoxic response, specifically how your brain and to a certain extent your eye respond in that type of extreme environment.
Does your eye recover when you come back to more normal oxygen pressures?
Yes, many things do recover, but you have to remember that the brain, of which the eye is part of, is one of the most metabolically active part of our body. It draws, you know, something like 20% the oxygen, and so it's particularly vulnerable to the effect of hypoxia. So if the hypoxia is sustained, then there are some cells, like neurons, in the brain that may be lost as a result of that.
Joe has a question for you. And Joe said, does temperature have anything to do with the eye-brain issues that you talked about in the first period? While most of the environment is controlled in temperature, I guess there are scenarios where you might be in some really cold space temperatures. How does temperature impact on the eye-brain issues?
Yeah, that's a good question. Certainly has not been well studied. In general, the signal transmission in the brain is affected by temperature. So a good example is cooler temperature usually is slightly better for signal transmission. So, you know, by information transfer from the eye to the brain, for example. And warmer temperature, things can be more likely to break down. This is observed in patients with certain neurological diseases like multiple sclerosis, for example. However, in extreme cold temperatures, basically it would be non-physiologic for sustained, human survival. But if you think about it, in extreme lower temperatures, all of these fluid shifts and transport of molecules from one part of the eye to the other part. We call these axonal transport because they're being moved in both directions along the optic nerve. All of those things will be impacted. So I'm not sure if the net effect is a positive or negative, but if I were to guess, I would think that cooler temperature would be temporarily a protective effect, because things are basically, you could imagine it being, things are kind of slightly more frozen in space, so all the deleterious effects of things that could happen are briefly slightly better control in a cooler temperature. Kind of like how we use low body temperature as a treatment for these severe strokes. So we do hypothermia in order to stretch out the period of time where doctors have a chance to do something. And of course, you know, it would be difficult to do these mitigations in space. But, you know, cooler temperature may be slightly better.
Marcia is in Atlanta, and she said, is what you've been talking about the only significant visual risk for astronauts in space, or are there others of equal concern or close to equal concern that we should be aware of?
I guess I need some clarification. Are you talking about the sort of focus issue being the optic nerve swelling being the primary concern, or if there are other changes in the eye-brain network?
Unless she sends in a clarification, I would think she's talking about the swelling of the optical nerve due to fluid shifts that you mentioned as we started out the discussion and talked about mostly. What other problems loom out there for visual problems for astronauts? I think that's where she's going.
Got it. So there's definitely more. What I haven't mentioned includes sort of circles back to the hypoxia question. So there are things called cotton wool spots, which are little areas of loss of oxygen that are visible right inside the eye. So we know that the loss of oxygen is an issue because of the presence of these cotton wool spots. They're also present in high-altitude expeditions. Other things include these folds in the retina. And so the wrinkles in the retina are part of the changes in the eye-brain network that are irreversible, meaning they don't go away completely. Kind of like if you have a wooden floor, it gets flooded, then, you know, there's always like a little bit of a ripple to it. And that's, those are the changes in the eye. So, you know, not just the optic nerve, but the retina itself, as well as, changes in, that's related to the blood vessel. So little hemorrhages, or cotton wool spots. And then in addition, there are many changes in the brain that we haven't discussed. So all of these things are done based on MRI studies. So these are magnetic resonance imaging of the brain after the astronauts have returned to Earth. And what we see is essentially this is present in 100% of astronauts. So in the microgravity space, it's well known that the whole brain floats a little bit upwards. And these are changes are persistent even when they're back on Earth. So there's some, changes in the relationship of the different brain parts. For example, structures are in the middle of the brain, like the pituitary gland, which is responsible for regulating hormones in your body. Its relationship to the other structures are slightly altered as a result of the prolonged microgravity. And there's a little bit more crowding on the very upper surface of the brain. And you could imagine that this could affect the function of those areas, even though we don't know for sure exactly how. The NASA twin study has done a little bit of comparison. So this is sort of the famous study that was published in Science in 2019, looking at everything that has to do, that has been changed for this pair of twins, the Kellys. And there are some differences Scott, the one who was in space, had, although basically the brain function is still extraordinary and quite intact, there were some important differences in terms of the brain function, as well as in the telomeres, the epigenome, the proteins, and a whole variety of things that are still being analyzed.
You have another call waiting. Hello, caller. Welcome to the program today. Who are you and where are you?
This is John in Fort Worth.
Hi, John. How are you today?
Well, yeah, I almost preempted. I was just about to ask, how does it affect the brain? well, these brain changes, are they going to actually affect the astronauts' functioning that you're seeing, the ones that you're mentioning?
Better study will definitely help answer that question, but I could tell you that the areas of the brain, other than the part that has to do with vision and hormones, which are obviously very important, the parts of the brain that are potentially affected has to do with the frontal lobe, for example, which are important for decision making and, these higher order executive functions, and so it's a real concern, because you could imagine, on a 6 to 9 months flight, not only is the vision blurry and altered, but they're having difficulty making smart decisions in space, and these are among the smartest people we have that we rely on to make these changes. Just keep in mind, these are typically scientists and engineers who are occupied, for many hours a day doing experiments or repairing and maintaining sophisticated equipment. So even though it's not well studied in terms of exactly which part is affected, just the part that we already know is of high concern.
Mm-hmm. Well, they do like some kind of testing before the flight, and then maybe some testing after flight in terms of, we're talking like something that would be like some kind of intelligence testing or some other kind of decision testing, and see how they what their performance would be before and after or something like that.
These astronauts are extensively tested pre and post flight. So yes, absolutely, these things are assessed. And specifically, it was looked at in the twin study. But basically, none of these studies are done quite right, because technically, you want to have them done while in flight. Right, like some kind of questionnaires or some kind of assessment, because that's the only way you could tell when they're potentially at their worst. So that's not been done, to my knowledge. But there is quite a bit now that we can do to assess eye and brain issues, but it's probably more is needed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but it seemed like something like that would be a useful thing to do.
Agree. And actually, it's not just in space that these are issues. I was looking into how pilots undergo these hypoxia experiences, as part of their training. And I learned that during the hypoxic exposure and experience, there's actually also not very good assessment of these, brain functions, right? Like, essentially, if the cabin is suddenly depressurized and they have to make rapid decisions to save their lives, there's still not enough research to understand the effect of hypoxia, which is part of high altitude or just depressurization for flights in terms of how we can rapidly tell if the brain is working or not.
Yeah. I remember we had an issue on the F-22 program a few years ago with that exact issue, and included a case where apparently a pilot pretty much crashed his plane right into the ground and up in Alaska, which led to a major study and some changes and things. So,
yeah, well, it may have contributed to this requirement for, you know, hypoxia experience for pilots. There are other things I've learned about all of that too. But you know, basically, everyone's brain is a little different, and their hypoxia, you know, symptoms are a bit different, and so that's why it's important to do this. And you probably know that most of the people who are training to be pilot or being recertified to be pilot. Most of the people who are undergoing these hypoxia training experiences are pretty young. And so we presume that it's possible if you're older that you may be even more vulnerable to some of these hypoxic effects. And so, you know, I mean, that's a whole other discussion. But I think in general, it's important to understand how our brain changes, you know, rapidly in these type of extreme situations.
Yes. Well, okay, well, thanks a lot. I'll get off the line and see if anybody else has some questions.
Thank you, John.
Okay, bye.
Listeners, it's still time. If you would like to call us, 1-866-687-7223, email drspace, drspace, at thespaceshow.com. I'm just thinking about wanting to go to space, and I'm not sure exactly what the physical makeup will be of people that are going to be space tourists, for example, or maybe early space settlers, but they may not be as physically fit as astronauts. So does physical fitness play a role in any of what we've talked about today? So just normal people off the street that could afford to go to space, that want to go to space, do they face harsher issues along the lines of what we've been talking about than a physically fit astronaut?
There is a growing interest in space tourism, and these are typically relatively short. So, you know, it could be anywhere from just going around the orbit to actually spending a little bit of longer time, like in an equivalent of a space hotel. So I think because these are relatively short duration experiences, I would expect that their difficulties would be less. You know, you still have to undergo some pretty rigorous training and screening process, but the cutoff, you know, for different is much different than the astronauts, and certainly they will be supported by people who are experienced astronauts. But I think the idea of the space tourism is to increase interest in this area and allow us to further develop in terms of our space capabilities. So this SpaceX, you know, successful launch yesterday is kind of a perfect example of more than 10-year effort of incorporating sort of commercial aspect of space program. Engaging resources beyond the U.S. government, we're able to offset the cost of a successful space program and increase interest in general. So, for example, it didn't really come upon as being important, but one of the key things is SpaceX is able to deliver goods to and from the International Space Station, and you know they've been doing that successfully. And so, adding humans, so you know, astronauts, exemplified by yesterday's successful launch, it becomes sort of a natural part of that whole system. in a way, you know, different from the space shuttle program. But, you know, it's really going to be fascinating, the sort of commercial aspect of space program and space tourism. So I'm hoping more people would be able to participate and contribute in a way that would be even more exciting in the next 10 years.
So if we could take a to and from trip to Mars, now we're talking about something much longer, maybe 3 years total. Would physical fitness play a role there, do you think?
So just traveling to Mars takes so long that some of the movies that have looked at this issue becomes, you know, real. You know, you may be thinking it more like a one-way trip, you know, as opposed to a round trip. And absolutely, physical fitness, you know, I think at every level would be critical because all the health issues that we're talking about just with a 3 month, you know, space experience will probably be multiplied several fold. So as I mentioned when we started this program, humans are not physically capable of going to Mars right now, you know, just by the eye brain issues alone, most likely, not to mention, you know, all aspects of human health in space. So I think it will be interesting to look at all these issues and the requirements that would be needed in order to make the trip.
Do you see roadblocks in humans wanting to live on the moon, go to the moon? If we say 2028 is the real schedule for getting humans back on the moon, are we going to advance enough in human factors, eye studies, intervention strategy to make 2028 plausible for safety, or would it be terribly, terribly risky for humans to even go to the moon by then?
Well, this is why the first question from John about the, you know, lower gravity in the moon was actually a very interesting one. So we have no idea what that might look like, you know, 3 to 6 months spent on the moon rather than the International Space Station. So I would think, at least from the iBrain perspective, that we have a real chance of being able to spend extensive amount of time in the moon. But keep in mind that, you know, there are many different purposes why we're suddenly interested in the moon again. One, you know, may involve the moon as sort of a relay station to go to Mars. And another may be to harvest important resources that are only available in the moon. So some purposes would require just short-term expeditions while, you know, we can learn about what happens when people spend a relatively shorter amount of time, like 3 months or 6 months in the moon, and then that will expand the possibility of longer-term experiences.
Linda's in Phoenix, Arizona. It's kind of an interesting question. And she says, Doctor, I'm interested in your medical profession, which I guess your specialty is neuro-ophthalmology. Is the space aspect of neuro-ophthalmology a big component of your discipline, or are there just a few of you interested in it?
Good question. So neuro-ophthalmologists, they're relatively fewer of us, just in general, because we're the smallest subspecialty in both neurology and ophthalmology. And there are even fewer of us who are specifically interested in space. So, you know, I consider myself kind of a enthusiast, and I can't claim that I've done, you know, really that much research, but certainly my research is relevant to these eye brain issues in space. So I would love to have more people who are not just interested, but also be trained in these eye brain diseases, because I think it's going to be particularly important, not just for space exploration, but also for human health.
So I have another sort of interesting question. It's kind of interesting to me. So this is Randy, and he's in Chicago. And Randy says, I'm a PhD scientist, and when I look at different things, I always seem to look at them and wonder what the consequences or the relationship might be to my interest in space. I'm wondering, when you see ophthalmology patients and you see what conditions they may or may not have or what the circumstances are of why they're visiting you, do you have a tendency to see them in a relationship to space research and what it may or may not mean, or is this totally irrelevant?
I think human beings are just by nature, you know, we're inquisitive, and we're inquisitive in a background of our own experiences and interests. So, you know, Randy, what you're saying makes sense for everyone. We're all interested in things that are that we know about and are interested in. And so, in general, the connection between, you know, day-to-day patients versus space, it doesn't come up all the time. But I could tell you it's exactly how I got interested in space in the first place. So I have a patient who got me interested in these space issues. So it's actually thanks to my patient that I got engaged.
Would you like to be a go to space and do on-the-job research if there is any to do for ophthalmology in space, or can it all be done by equipment and robotic measurements?
The beauty of these eye-brain research and the advancement in the imaging technology is that we could actually do a lot remotely. So during COVID-19 is a perfect example of how telemedicine just kind of kicked off, and most of the patients that I'm seeing currently are actually through telemedicine. And so, you know, it is possible to do this in space. I would say that for me personally, I think I'm too old to go to space for extended period of time. It would be amazing if I could have some kind of experience. So I was listening when you were talking about these, sponsors in between the two segments. But, you know, basically, I think the data that's currently being acquired in space will be very substantial, and I would love, you know, just as a realistic step, I would love to contribute to that type of analysis, because as I mentioned, some of the analysis is actually not trivial, and it depends on people who are in the field to actually know what to do with. So I think that's a more realistic goal for me.
Is the issue of eye-brain issues in microgravity, is that mostly research that's done in the United States, or do you have peers all over the world doing this kind of research?
There's really very little being done outside of, you know, major organizations. So certainly U.S. probably has the most amount of dollars invested in this type of research, which is still limited, but they have more than anyone else. For sure, ESA, the European counterpart of NASA, and JAXA, which is the Japanese counterpart, have some interest, but the sort of grant funding for the research is more limited. And then other countries are doing their own thing. And so I think from an eye-brain standpoint, as far as I know, there's not a international effort. The most international effort I could imagine is essentially the equipment being made available in the International Space Station so that any astronaut who has issues are able to have access to these measurements in space.
If we had space hotels or space settlements would this equipment be standard operating equipment at those facilities to use for people using these facilities, maybe even staff, and then there would be some staff people trained to use it? Would this be like the standard medical equipment on board a space hotel, for example, or at a space settlement?
I think that would make sense. And the it's kind of like a cruise ship. You know, you the kind of equipment you have available will be a balance of knee versus space issue. And I think the imaging and the measurement instruments is a no-brainer, you know, by having that available, because they're relatively easy to operate. It's kind of like a point-and-shoot system. And some of the fancier measurements will take a little bit more training and a bigger footprint in terms of the instrument. But having some kind of basic measurement, you know, like a handheld device, it would make sense that this would be part of just being able to assess the eye and the brain function in addition to, other key aspects of the human body.
So you could be the cruise doctor ophthalmologist equivalent at a space hotel for 2 weeks or a month.
Wow. I think you just came up with a way I could maybe actually afford it.
That's right. And while you're not examining crazy people screwing around on the space station or the space hotel, you could be giving lectures like you did to AIAA or here on the space show. So,
wow.
And
sounds wonderful.
And
I love it.
And you might even get paid in addition to your trip. So this is a new job created by commercial space. So
space program is certainly opened up from a medical standpoint, opened up a lot of different interesting aspects that are also relevant to Earth, you know, health. And so I feel just in general, this is why I'm so excited about space, because it not only gives you these sort of, you know, opens your eyes to thinking about things beyond yourself, and thinking about how we could, collaborate, you know, as a human race to, achieve something greater, and then having these, you know, exciting possibilities that could propagate back, to Earth. And maybe for me personally, that would be wonderful.
Did you watch the SpaceX launch yesterday?
I did. It was, you know, really exciting, and you could tell the announcers are like just having butterflies, you know, in the pit of their stomach, and I mean, there's a lot of excitement across. What I'm hoping a lot of the listeners are also able to watch that. If you haven't, it's really worth looking at the footage, both for the takeoff, you know, with the Falcon rocket, as well as the docking that happened this morning.
Right. We're at the end of our program. Have we missed anything that you think we should have discussed, or have we failed to ask you a question that only out of ignorance that we should have maybe asked you?
This is a terrific audience. The questions are amazing and comprehensive. It also gave me, you know, a bunch of things to think about. So I really just appreciate so much to be part of this wonderful show.
Well, thank you, and I hope you'll keep me updated on some of your research. We'd love to talk to you some more about this later on, or if you're making presentations or something, we'd love to be able to follow it. So do stay in touch. And I will archive this program and send you the location of it and all of that either later today or tomorrow morning. But we certainly thank you for joining us, and certainly thank you for your great research. And I'm sure the archive audience will find it fascinating and interesting as well, too.
Thank you.
Thank you. Listeners, that's it for today. And again, Dr. Dana Andrew with his reflections is back on Tuesday evening. Everybody have a great rest of the weekend. If you did not see the SpaceX launch, it's all over YouTube. Go watch it. It's 10 minutes to space, including the recovery of the first stage, which is pretty amazing in itself. We want to thank Dr. Lau for being with us, all of you for your calls and emails. Goodbye from Dr. Lau, David, and the Space Show. Keep looking up, everybody.